This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day-to-day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we're featuring. Coming up, Marina Hyde looks at the state of our water industry and the Thames water crisis following a plague-filled boat race. Singer-songwriter Nick Cave on his art, ceramic figurines, and the death of his two sons. And what does bread in Britain tell us about health, wealth, and class? Just a warning, there's a bit of bad language in this episode. Now, it took a sewage-plagued boat race to do it, but as Marina Hyde explains here, people can now see the appalling state of England's water industry and waterways. Read by Colleen Prendergast.
Fire up a Chariots of Fire-style theme tune for the speech of the defeated Oxford captain in last Saturday's boat race, beamed edifyingly around the world. "We had a few guys go down pretty badly with E. coli," declared Lenny Jenkins. The university's boat club itself says it can't be that specific on precisely what caused the gut rot. Having shared a few of the nauseating details, Jenkins concluded, "It would be a lot nicer if there wasn't as much poo in the water." Yup, a country that once painted a quarter of the world pink now regrettably advertises itself as mostly brown, encircled by its own effluent and pumping it furiously through its river veins just to be sure. As metaphors go, it is on the nose in all senses. And so to Thames Water, steward of the river on which that internationally famous race is rowed, a firm that is £18 billion in deliriously structured debt, has had to be extensively threatened to spend so much as 30p on infrastructure investment, spent years being used as a cash cow for shareholders, and has pumped human waste into the Greater London area of the river for almost 2,000 hours already this year alone. Despite this rapacious shareholder-facing culture, its current foreign investors have now apparently judged it to be uninvestable. Thames Water's relatively new CEO, Chris Weston, must be struck by that feeling that plagued Tony Soprano. "It's good to be in something from the ground floor," the mobster judged. "I came too late for that, I know. But lately, I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over." This isn't the line Chris Weston is going with in public, chirping to the Sunday Times. "I think the water industry, the characteristics it has as a regulated monopoly, is very attractive to some types of investors." He should probably tell that to the ones walking away, even as Thames has spent much of the past 5 years trying to get Ofwat to let it raise bills, most recently by up to 40%. Ofwat is, of course, the water industry's regulator. If I could do double sarcastic air quotes, I would, and perhaps the only entity more full of shit than the rivers and seas it's supposed to give one about. Civic-minded individuals, such as the campaigner Fergal Sharkey, or groups including Surfers Against Sewage, have made all the running and worked long and tirelessly to push this issue into the public consciousness, and from there to outrage. The part that Chris has correctly said out loud, however, is that back in 1989, the water industry wasn't privatised in any true sense of the term. In fact, the Conservative government of the day held a sale of monopoly rights. State assets were parcelled out into private hands, and those who picked up these monopolies have spent decades doing grotesquely well for themselves at the expense of the captive nation that is stuck with them. They are, effectively, oligarchs, and even if they can't boil their enemies in vats of scalding water like their Russian counterparts, they can certainly make them swim in seas of sewage. As Sun Tzu said, if you wait by the river long enough, the turds of your enemies will float by. I say long enough, 30 seconds should probably do it. You hear a lot about how the water industry was privatised for ideological reasons, but surely few ideologies could be more universally shared than the one that should see them renationalised. Namely, I strongly believe that pumping raw sewage into our seas and rivers is both literally and qualitatively shit. Come on, this really is the great unifier. In an atomised and polarised age, you can't knock the sheer percentage of people who would, right now, be able to put all their other differences aside and unite behind the idea of that one. The public didn't back water privatisation at the time it happened, and they sure as surely back it even less now. Plenty of Conservatives will gladly tell you that privatising utilities was always madness, for reasons ranging from economic and civic to national security, and Britain is far from the only place around the world where water privatisation has demonstrably not worked. The public is also not stupid and knows very well that it's going to be on the hook for the various firms' massive debts, one way or another. If Thames is currently £18 billion in debt and heading for collapse, the £15 billion that is the estimated cost of renationalising the entire sector starts to look like long-term good value. Quite why Keir Starmer has rowed back on Labour's previous pledge to renationalise the water industry is unclear. Presumably, the best way to look like you're responsible with money is to present yourself as the continuity candidate, letting calamitously run monopolies spray it everywhere, then demand that consumers of that luxury product, water, foot the bill yet again. That said, at the current rate of malfunction, Thames Water's crisis will be upon us sooner than any general election. Yet where is the sense of urgency? Last year, the government gave the water companies until 2050 to stop dumping sewage into seas and waterways. Incredible, really, when targets are this low bar that hitherto the companies have still failed to clear them every time. Someone, anyone, is going to have to think what to do about this wretched oligarchy. Those in charge ought to be long past the point of looking busy and simply holding their noses.
That was Look at the Thames and Know the Time for Metaphors is Over. Our Politics is Drowning in Effluent by Marina Hyde. Read by Colleen Prendergast. Next, in the past 9 years, the musician and artist Nick Cave has lost two sons, an experience he explores in a shocking, deeply personal new ceramics project. Here he discusses mercy, forgiveness, making, and meaning. By Simon Hattonstone. Read by Jason Doan.
Nick Cave has a touch of Dr. Frankenstein about him. Long white lab coat, inscrutable smile, unnerving intensity. He introduces me to his two assistants, the identical twins Liv and Dom Cave Sutherland, who are helping to glaze his ceramic series, The Devil, A Life. The twins are not related to Cave. His wife, the fashion designer Susie Cave, came across them one day, discovered they were ceramicists, and thought they would be able to help him complete his project. It adds to the eeriness of it all. Cave, 66, is one of the world's great singer-songwriters. From the howling post-punk of The Birthday Party and The Bad Seeds to the lugubrious lyricism of his love songs, Into My Arms, Straight to You, and A Million Others I Adore. And the haunted grief of recent albums such as Skeleton Tree, Ghosteen, and Carnage. He is also a fine author. See his apocalyptic novel And the Ass Saw the Angel. Thinker, his book of conversations with the Observer journalist Sean O'Hagan, Faith, Hope and Carnage. Agony Uncle, at his website, The Red Hand Files. Screenwriter, The Proposition. And now, visual artist, which is where he started out half a century ago. Cave studied art in Melbourne in the mid-70s, before being chucked off his degree course. He reckons he was too fascinated by the subject for his own good. He spent all his time talking about art to the older students and didn't find the hours to do the actual work. Now he's making up for lost time. We are at the headquarters of Susie's business, where she makes and stores the beautiful dresses she designs as the vampire's wife. For now, it's doubling as Cave's studio. He gives me a tour of the 17 ceramic figurines, which will be exhibited at Xavier Hufkins in Brussels next month. The pieces are stunning in a creepy, cave-esque way. All blood-curdling pastoral idylls. But it's as a series that they are most powerful. The sculptures, inspired by Staffordshire flat-back ceramics from the Victorian era, forge a shocking and deeply personal narrative. Initially, we see the devil as a child, a cute little lad, dimple-cheeked in a white jumpsuit sitting next to a red monkey. "Look at his little face," Cave says lovingly. We see the devil getting up to erotic mischief with a sailor, then ecstatic with his first love. "I'm extremely happy with this one," Cave says. His impish pleasure and her just drained of life. We see the devil going to war in a field of flowers, wading through a field of blood and skulls on his return, and getting married. Then the series takes a traumatic turn. "This is the devil kills his first child," Cave says. "It's a little Isaac and Abraham thing. Then he's separated from the world. Life goes on. Then he dances for the last time." And now we're at the final piece. Cave continues. He bleeds to death. He's found washed up, and the child is forgiving him, leaning out to him with his hand. It's impossible to know how to respond when Cave reaches the story's conclusion, other than to gulp or weep. After all, this is a man who has lost two sons over the past 9 years. In 2015, 15-year-old Arthur died after taking LSD for the first time and falling from a cliff near his home in Brighton. In 2022, 31-year-old Jethro, who had schizophrenia, died in Melbourne. Death and grief have informed all of Cave's work since Arthur died, but this takes it to another level. We say goodbye to the Cave twins, who continue painting pubic hair in gold luster on the devil's first love. "We'll see you guys. Slave away, my children," Cave says. Liv smiles. "I'm already dressed like a Victorian child," Dom says. "A pint of stout for lunch," Cave says. We move into Susie's office to chat. It's dark, gothic, a dream home for bats. He whips off his lab coat to reveal an immaculate three-piece suit and sits behind the desk. Before I sit down, I ask if I can do something I have wanted to do for the best part of a decade. I reach over the desk and clumsily hug him. Oh, man, here, let me stand up. The last time we talked was 16 years ago. He was making a video that featured Arthur and his twin brother, Earl, who were then 7, gorgeous and already musical. Arthur was playing drums, Earl guitar. Cave became famous as one of the bad boys of rock, a ghoulish junkie with a feral live act, equally fixated by the Bible and Beelzebub. But he is one of the nicest people I have met. In 2008, I turned up knowing sod all about him. I tell him that he was so generous with his time and non-judgmental about my ignorance. Really? He says, surprised. That's good to know. I tend to have a low opinion of myself back then. I see a cut-off point around the death of my first son of a change of character. But it's not as black and white as I thought. Every Cave story seems to begin with a death. Take the origin of the figurines. He went into the studio to start work on them the day his mother, Dawn, died. He had planned to start on that date, 15th September 2020, for a while. Susie made me go. She said, "Get there and do your work." He adored Dawn. She had always stood by him, no matter what trouble he was in. The day his father died in a car crash, she was called to the police station to bail out 19-year-old Cave after he had been charged with burglary. Did he have any idea what he wanted to create in the studio? No, he said, but there was an inevitability about the subject. Even when I'm trying to use art to escape certain feelings and sorrows I have, everything just seems to fall into the slipstream of the loss of my son. And even when I was glazing these, Jethro died. So it's like... He comes to a stop. What I'm trying to say is these losses are just incorporated into the artistic flow and they move in a direction that is beyond your capacity to rein in. They're just sitting at the end of everything you do. In the end, the ceramics are a story about a man's culpability in the loss of his child, and addressing that in a way I wasn't really able to do with music. Does he feel culpable for the death of his sons? I think it's something that people who lose children feel regardless of the situation, simply because the one thing you're supposed to do is not let your children die. He comes to another abrupt stop, almost as if he's dictating notes. Forget that. The one thing you're supposed to do is protect your children. He returns to the final figurine. You have this hollowed-out old man with a little child, possibly a dead old man, dead in a pool of tears, a biblical flood of tears, shall we say, and the little child is reaching down in forgiveness. It's called The Devil Forgiven. He smiles. I hope this isn't too abstract, too woo-woo. Art has a way of bringing to you the things you need to know. It feels to me that art knows what's going on more than the artist knows what's going on. Does he feel culpable because drugs were involved in Arthur's death? There could be some element of that, yeah. Look, these things are in our DNA. They're inherited. I don't want to make any assumptions about Arthur, who was just a young boy. It's not like he was into drugs. On a fundamental level, it's against nature to be burying your children. And there can't help but be feelings of culpability. Cave believes he is emerging from his losses a different man. He has a point. It's hard to imagine the old Cave curating the Red Hand files, a website in which he invites fans to ask questions about anything they want, many of them profoundly personal. Soon after Arthur's death, the family moved to Los Angeles for a couple of years. We were triggered too much by things. We were just down the road from where it happened, he states. Everybody seemed to know what had happened to Arthur because it was so widely reported. But he says that ended up being a positive. I was forced to grieve publicly, and that was helpful, weirdly enough. It stopped me completely shutting the windows, bolting the doors, and just living in this dark world. He was overwhelmed by the kindness of strangers. I had letter after letter addressed to Nick Cave, Brighton. It was a really extraordinary thing. And that attention and sense of community were extremely helpful to me. I think people are usually just on their own with these sorts of things. Susie met somebody whose son had died 7 years previously, and she still hadn't spoken to her husband about it. These people are utterly alone and maybe full of rage, so I can't overstate that I've been in an extraordinarily privileged position in that respect. Did his experience of bereavement help after Jethro died? Yeah, it really helped, because I knew I could get through. I'd been through it. Did he feel cursed? No, I don't feel cursed, no. He says it would be wrong to talk publicly about Jethro. He didn't meet Jethro till he was 7, and their relationship was complex. Although they became close, it would be disrespectful to his mother who brought him up. Cave's first 2 children, Luke and Jethro, were born 10 days apart to different women. Cave says one way in which he has changed is that he appreciates life more. In the past, he has described learning to live again, refinding happiness, as an act of defiance. But he no longer thinks it's an appropriate word. Defiance has a fuck you element to the world. We're not going to let it get us down. That sounds a little too heroic now. I'm pretty simple-minded about things. It says something to my children who have died that I can enjoy my life now. It's what they would want. I think it's a softer relationship we have to the world now. Rather than a 2-fingered salute to fate, it goes back to culpability and his Christian, if questioning, faith. Look, this is extremely difficult to talk about, but one of the things that used to really worry me is that Arthur, wherever he may be, if he is somewhere, somehow understands what his parents are going through because of something he did, and that his condition of culpability is not dissimilar to mine. And I think that's the reason behind a lot of what I do. It's to say it's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but we're okay. We're okay. I think Susie feels that too. He stresses that he is not just talking about his personal tragedies. What's it saying to all those people who've passed away in their multitudes if we lead lives where we're just pathologically pissed off at the world? What does it say to those who have left the world to be in a perpetual state of misery and fury and depression and cynicism towards the world? What legacy are they leaving if that's how we manifest the passing of that person? He thinks people sometimes misunderstand what he is saying about loss. It's not that there is more joy in his world than there was, far from it. But when it comes, it tends to be more intense. Joy is something that leaps unexpectedly and shockingly out of an understanding of loss and suffering. That's how Susie and I are. That's in no way saying we're not affected, or we've somehow gotten over it, or we've had closure, or even acceptance. I think closure is a dumb thing. Even acceptance is like, just give it a few years and life goes back to how it was. It doesn't happen. You're fundamentally changed. Your very chemistry is changed. And when you're put back together again, you're a different person. The world feels more meaningful. He knows plenty of people disagree with him. I get people, mothers particularly, occasionally saying, "How dare you suggest there is joy involved in any of this?" People are so angry, and they have every right to be enraged by the fucked up cosmic mischief that goes on, and it's deeply unfair. but it's not personal. It feels like it is, but it's just the vicissitudes of life. Cave feels he is misunderstood in another way, after saying recently that he has always been temperamentally conservative and attacking the self-righteous belief and lack of humility of woke culture. This has led some to assume he is supping with the alt-right, which couldn't be further from the truth. Conservatism is a difficult word to talk about in Britain, because people immediately think of the Tories. But I do think small c conservatism is someone who has a fundamental understanding of loss, an understanding that to pull something down is easy. To build it back up again is extremely difficult. There is an innate need in us to rip shit down, and I'm personally more cautious in that respect, without it being a whole political ideology that surrounds me. Is he a Tory? I'm not a Tory, no. Has he ever been? No. I've never voted Tory. And is he really anti-woke? The concept that there are problems with the world we need to address, such as social justice, I'm totally down with that. However, I don't agree with the methods that are used in order to reach this goal. Shutting down people, cancelling people. There's a lack of mercy, a lack of forgiveness. These go against what I fundamentally believe on a spiritual level as much as anything. So it's a tricky one. The problem with the right taking hold of this word is that it's made the discussion impossible to have without having to join a whole load of nutjobs who have their problem with it. He hates dogma, whether religious or political. His work has always embraced uncertainty. People don't like me to say this, but I do feel it's in my nature to constantly be redressing the balance of my own ideas about things. My mother was exactly the same. She always saw the other side. It was incredibly frustrating. You'd be angry about something and she'd go, "Yes, darling, but..." Like his mother, he has never shied away from the trickiest buts. When he talks about his appalling loss, he also knows he has been lucky. Not only has he been able to express his grief in his work, but it has also fed his creativity. Even at its bleakest, he has found it cathartic. Making art is in itself the great expression of joy and optimism, in my view. That's why we need it. Music, art, reminds us of our fundamental capacity to create beautiful things out of the fuckeries of life. Even when I'm making The Devil Kills His First Child, I'm not depressed. I'm like, wow, look at the head. It's a joyful occupation, no matter what. And when I'm singing a very sad lyric, it doesn't mean I'm sad inside. The forthcoming Bad Seeds album is the first thing he's created since Arthur's death that isn't set through a lens of loss. He's funny when talking about his work. So angsty and uncertain early in the process, almost messianic by the end. The new album is really good. It's really strong. Great songs, he says. Similarly, with The Devil a Life, he has got over the doubts, and now he's buzzing with self-belief. Is he nervous about the exhibition? No, I'm excited. I think the ceramics are really good and really strange. But he feels unusually protective towards his figurines and the story that they tell. These guys feel extraordinarily vulnerable. They are vulnerable little things, and they're saying something deeply personal.
That was Nick Cave on love, art, and the loss of his sons. It's Against Nature to Bury Your Children by Simon Hattonstone. Read by Jason Doan. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Weekend. Finally, some complain that pricey sourdough is elitist and pretentious. Others lambast cheap sliced white as unhealthy and unsustainable. How did our most basic foodstuff become a source of conflict and division? By Rachel Dixon. Read by Colleen Prendergast.
The cheapest loaf in my nearest supermarket costs 45p. The cheapest loaf in my local artisanal bakery costs £5. Which of these facts winds you up? For Giles Yeo, a professor of molecular neuroendocrinology at the University of Cambridge, it is the £5 sourdough. Writing in The Guardian this month, he railed against bougie bakeries charging more for fancy bread. For Chris Young, the coordinator of the Real Bread campaign, it is the 45p white sliced. In response to Yeo's article, he pointed out that ultra-processing enables supermarkets to sell bread so cheaply. This was just one recent spat in Britain's long-running bread wars. It prompts two questions. How can something that requires only four ingredients, flour, water, yeast, and salt, diverge so wildly in price? And how did our most basic foodstuff become so divisive? Penn Vogler, the author of Stuffed, says it is precisely because bread is fundamental to our diets. For good or ill, we have decided on our rain-soaked island that wheat bread is our staple, she says. Bread has been divisive from our earliest records. Like so many things, it is tied up with class. In her previous book, Scoff, Vogler wrote, "Ideas of social status and the colour of your bread go back to Roman times. The Lord's bread was snowy white, and it was up to the rest of the household to know the colour of their bread, and therefore their place. It took time and money to produce white flour. The culture wars were always about white bread versus brown," says Vogler. Technology has since relegated white sliced to the cheapest option. Wheat used to be crushed between stones to make flour, mixing the bran, germ, and endosperm together, which could then be sieved to make it whiter. Then, in the 1870s, came steel rollers that ripped off the brown bran and oily germ, making white flour in a flash. Workers had access to white bread for the first time. After being told for centuries that white bread was too good for the likes of them, it isn't surprising that easy-to-eat, comforting white bread is what people wanted, wrote Vogler. Another game-changer was the advent of the Chorleywood bread process, CBP, in the 1960s. High-speed mixers slashed the time it took to make a loaf. Instead of having to wait for the dough to rise, it was instantly ready to bake. Suddenly, factory bread was the fastest and cheapest around. Today, it is estimated that 80% of British bread is produced using the CBP, and another 15% by other automated processes in supermarkets, in-store bakeries. Only 5% comes from craft bakeries, and some of those may use additives. What went so wrong? Let's start with the flour. My £5 sourdough contains regeneratively farmed flour. It comes from locally grown, micronutrient-rich heritage wheat varieties sown in grass, alongside other plants and grazing animals, without the use of pesticides or heavy machinery. The wheat in my 45p loaf is a modern hybrid, bred for its high yield and tolerance to pesticides, grown in a monoculture. The £5 loaf's wheat is stone ground into wholemeal flour, which, as it uses all parts of the grain, retains its protein, vitamins, fibre, and healthy fat. Cyclone milling is a more modern alternative. The 45p loaf's wheat is roller milled into white flour. This removes almost all the vitamin E and depletes a host of other vitamins and minerals. A handful are added back: calcium, iron, thiamine, niacin, and soon folic acid. Next comes water, salt, and yeast. The white sliced requires large amounts of water, is high in salt, and needs more yeast than traditionally made yeasted bread. The sourdough, on the other hand, contains no baker's yeast, unless it's a supermarket sour foe, and is instead made using a live sourdough starter, a flour and water mix containing the yeasts and lactic acid that live on the surface of cereal grains. This needs a much longer fermentation time before baking, which a growing number of studies suggest brings health benefits, including increased B vitamins and antioxidants, lower levels of acrylamide, a naturally occurring chemical that can increase the risk of cancer, and a lower glycemic index, although more research is needed. Ingredients-wise, there is nothing else in my 5-pound loaf. The label on my 45p loaf, however, lists a preservative, emulsifiers, vinegar, rapeseed oil, and a flour treatment agent. The manufacturer is not legally required to list the various processing aids, usually enzymes, used mainly to increase volume and prolong softness. Industrial bread is the poster child of ultra-processed food, says the Real Bread Campaign's Young. It's made using a whole cocktail of additives. The world's largest review into ultra-processed food found last month that it is directly linked to 32 harmful effects to health, including a higher risk of heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, adverse mental health, and early death. Surely the healthy loaves in the supermarket are okay? Hovis Seed Sensations, £1.90, is one of Waitrose's best-selling breads, promising omega-3 and protein from its blend of 6 seeds. I ask Chris Van Tulleken, the doctor and author of Ultra Processed People, to take a look at the label. It has all the hallmarks of an ultra processed food, preservative, emulsifier, flour treatment agent. But, says Van Tulleken, the ultra processing is just one aspect of it. Even if you don't care about that, according to UK dietary guidance, this bread is high in salt and sugar. At 278 calories per 100 grams, it has a higher calorie density than a Big Mac. It is also incredibly soft. Softness gives bread the illusion of freshness and makes us eat more of it. The trick can work in reverse too. In the two World Wars, and even as far back as the Napoleonic Wars, British bakers were banned from selling soft, fresh bread. It was known that firmer, older bread filled people up more, so they needed to eat less of it. This was a good thing when food was scarce, and it could be today amid an obesity crisis. Let's think hard about growing and consuming less, better wheat, says Andrew Whitley, the co-founder of the campaigning Growing and Baking Project, Scotland the Bread. If we can eat fewer slices of more satisfying bread, we take pressure off our belts, our food budgets, and the natural world, where biodiversity loss from intensive grain farming is as big a crisis as climate breakdown. Of course, that doesn't mean we all have to spend a fiver on sourdough. The Real Bread Campaign defines real bread simply as having no additives. Sourdough is the oldest way of making bread, but some people shun it because they think it's elitist. Others deliberately make it elitist, says Young. Bakers on Instagram posting pictures of sourdough with lots of holes are part of the problem, adds Whitley. This is about feeding people healthily on the basis of food justice and inequality. It's not about creating a hipster brand. Sourdough is a method, not a style. Almost any kind of bread can be made this way. Brioche, pizza bases, rotis, croissants. Still, there is no getting away from the fact that sourdough and other real bread is expensive. Is home baking the answer? Making your own is a glib, middle-class response, says Young. Someone working 14-hour shifts is going to struggle. Ditto people with limited cooking facilities or skills, or no access to good ingredients. Still, the sourdough craze during the pandemic showed that, given the time, bread making can be very rewarding. It's the alchemy says Young. You take three ingredients and make something amazing and delicious. For Whitley, who has campaigned for real bread for decades, the rise in baking is heartening. More people are baking better bread, says Whitley. Some are even starting their own businesses, from nano bakeries to full-scale artisanal bakeries. The bakery behind my £5 sourdough was born in lockdown. For those short of time or skill who want to bake at home, the Real Bread campaign has called a bread machine amnesty. Apparently, 1.4 million are languishing in kitchen cupboards. It is encouraging people to use them or give them to someone who will. That still leaves a lot of people who want to pop to the shops and buy a decent loaf without spending 10 times more than they do normally. How can we bridge the gap between the 45p white sliced and the £5 sourdough? During the Second World War, bakers could legally produce only a regulation loaf. This national loaf was subject to its own culture wars, says Whitley. Some referred to it as our murdered bread because it contained no wheat germ. At the other extreme, says Seamus Higgins, an associate professor of food process engineering at the University of Nottingham, the national loaf was sarcastically named Hitler's secret by people who were used to eating white bread. It was heavy and greyish beige in colour, crumbly in texture, and stale by the time it was purchased. Both agree that this high-fibre loaf, however controversial, was nutritious and helped to improve public health. While no one wants a return to grey wartime bread, Whitley thinks there is scope for a new, improved people's loaf. He envisions that it would be made from locally grown organic wheat, contain at least 75% wholemeal flour, be low in salt, and contain no additives. It could use either baker's yeast or a sourdough starter and be produced in all shapes and sizes, from a tin loaf to flatbreads, rolls and batons. The vision is a nutritious, affordable and accessible bread for everybody, he says. Meanwhile, some craft bakeries have real bread for all schemes to make their products affordable. Hearts and Batches Bakeries in Bristol have teamed up to make an artisanal bread similar to the white sliced many people are used to, but with 15% wholemeal flour and no additives. They subsidise the loaf and sell it for 75p from a mobile food shop in the BS13 postcode area, where 1 in 8 households live in extreme food insecurity. Aston's Bakehouse in Berkshire sells a people's loaf for £3.40, nearly 30% less than its next cheapest sourdough. To keep the price low, it is made from semolina, a milling byproduct, as well as wholemeal flour. In the north of Edinburgh, all bread at the Granton Garden Bakery is sold on a pay-what-you-can-afford basis. Can traditional baking be done at a scale that feeds everyone? Other countries suggest it is possible. Decades ago, I visited a factory in Russia making 100 tons of really good sourdough rye bread a day, says Whitley. They had simply scaled up exactly what a home or village baker did. Young says, we go on holiday to France or Italy, and there seems to be real bread on every street corner. There is an element of rose-tinted spectacles, but generally, the percentage of small, independent bakers is smaller in the UK than in France, Germany, or Italy. No one really knows why. Early industrialisation played a part, but Germany wasn't far behind Britain, and its pumpernickel is still made properly. France is the most interventionist country, according to Higgins. The 1993 Décret Pain, bread decree, states that baguettes must be made on the premises where they are sold and can be made only with wheat flour, water, salt and yeast. Lots of Britons grew up on white sliced and never lost their taste for it. We love the sweetness and softness, says Whitley. My mum used to bake wholemeal bread and I would escape to friends' houses to eat white sliced. Now he thinks white bread should be an occasional treat. Young agrees. We all had things we liked as children, but these things aren't necessarily good for us as adults. The point is that industrial bread is often the only option. We don't want to ban white sliced, he says. We want people to have the chance to choose an additive-free, high-fibre, preferably wholemeal loaf. Whitley adds, with white sliced being so cheap and hiding the reasons why it's so cheap, growing conditions, labour conditions, emissions, people are not able to make a reasoned choice. We've been doing this to poor people for 250 years. It's a matter of radical injustice. Vogler says cheap bread is symbolic of our broken food system. Others go further and argue that it reflects our splintered society. The number one problem is poverty and inequality, says Van Tulleken. The food industry is very skillful at appearing to be an ally of the people who are forced to eat its products. To criticise the gambling industry is not to stigmatise the gamblers. The focus of my critique is those individuals and institutions who could regulate this industry but fail to do so. Charities, politicians, scientists, and doctors who partner with companies that harm health. Protest can bring about real change, says Vogler. In the 19th century, bread used to be adulterated with alum, plaster of Paris, talcum powder. People who could only afford the cheapest bread were eating absolute rubbish. The Lancet, medical journal, and the middle classes made such a fuss about it that eventually the government introduced labelling laws. The Sale of Food and Drugs Act 1875 still forms the basis of food law in the UK. Maybe we can all agree that 45p is no bargain for an ultra-processed product and that £5 for a sourdough loaf prices out most people. We need a grassroots revolution, says Whitley. For once, it is hard to argue.
That was Britain's Bitter Bread Battle. What a £5 sourdough loaf tells us about health, wealth, and class. By Rachel Dixon. Read by Colleen Prendergast. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. Maybe even leave us a nice review or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles were read by Colleen Prendergast and John Doan and presented by me, Evelyn Miller. This episode was produced by Silas Gray. The executive producer is Danielle Stevens. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.